Sports Professor Rick Harrow, and welcome to Beyond the Scoreboard, the show that takes an inside look at the trillion-dollar business of sports, news, marketing, endorsements, law. Serious show that doesn't really take itself too seriously, but with this week, you better. The inauguration, I'm here at the National U.S. Conference of Mayors. Inauguration week in Washington, you love it, you hate it, but you've got to respect it, and you've got to recognize the orderly transition of power, which is what all the mayors and every elected official are honoring here. The mayors and sports and the president-elect in sports, a big theme as well. And also, obviously, the AFC and NFC championship. We have Pat Rooney Jr., a member of the famed, beloved Rooney family. I'm not quite sure they're beloved in New England right now as the Steelers take on the Patriots on Sunday in Foxborough, but certainly he has a lot to say and a lot of perspective. We'll have our normal big-time topics of the week. NASCAR just beginning to start. Golf season underway. Australian Open underway. Baseball signings continue. NHL ready for its All-Star game. NBA All-Star a few weeks away. The bottom line is the show is packed with information. We hope you stay tuned. Rick Harrow, Beyond the Scoreboard. Trillion-dollar business of sports. Big week to celebrate. NFC, AFC championship. Remember, look for us on Stitcher, Google Play, Audio Boom, and other places all across the planet where you can get our insight and our perspective. And speaking of insight and perspective, Pat Rooney has been a friend for a long time. Graduated from Clemson University with a BA in political science, so he's very happy. Villanova School of Law. MBA from Lehigh University. He's a founding member of the Golf Foundation, the president of Palm Beach County Golf Foundation. He's also been a representative in the Florida House District 85 for 6 years. He obviously is also a member of the Rooney family, who's owned the Steelers, by the way, since Art Rooney bought the team in 1933. Old guard versus new guard, Patriots versus Steelers. Can't wait to see it, and you ought to hear what Pat Rooney has to say. Sports Professor Rick Harrow keeping score beyond the boardroom, inside politics, sports, football. It converges, and it couldn't have converged at a better time. The dreaded Pittsburgh Steelers are taking on the New England Patriots. I better not say dreaded because of the guy that's on the line. He is Pat Rooney. Clemson University BA, Villanova, Lehigh, a representative from the Florida House from 2010 to 2016. He's FAU Honors College. We got a lot to talk about with Pat in addition to the matchup that's coming up. He's more importantly the president of the Palm Beach County Golf Association and the American Bar Association. Pat Rooney, which one is more important to you, the American Bar Association or the Palm Beach County Golf Association?
Oh, I'm going Golf Association, Rick. Sports has been a big part of my life. Golf in particular, since I was a little kid, one of the things that really helped me and my dad and our relationship as we, you know, went along in this life's journey. And I've been part of the Golf Association now for, God, almost 20 years. So that's much more important than something, you know, with the lawyers and falling asleep.
And there you go, ladies and gentlemen. And I also have seen him on the golf course, and he has a lot to be proud of with that swing. He's kind of a lanky dude, but, you know, the Roonies get things done, as we know. So before we get into some of the other important issues about the rest of your life, obviously the Roonies and the Steelers are inevitably and irrevocably linked as a brand, not only in Pittsburgh, but in the NFL. So will you first describe the considerable and ever-diverse Rooney family tree for us?
That is a tough question to answer, Rick, but I will say this. If your name is Art or Dan, you've got some link to the Rooney family. I think we, you know, researching it myself, I think there's five or six sets of Arts or Dans going back to the 1800s in Ireland and Scotland where, you know, my ancestors came from. So basically, in a real quick nutshell, my Uncle Dan is the oldest of five brothers. My grandfather, Art, started the team in 1933. And then Dan, our junior, Tim, and then my dad, Pat and John, are twins. They're the two youngest. So there's five brothers. And like I said, if your name's Art or Dan, then your chances are very good that you're somewhere in the Rooney family.
Ladies and gentlemen, do you get that? Is there a pecking order, by the way, of older Rooney siblings and younger Rooney siblings, where you sit in the suite, who gets the right tickets, who gets to yell the loudest? How does that all work around the Thanksgiving table?
Well, in the old days, yes. If you were the oldest Rooney male, then that gave you some level of prestige. But since we've been, for estate reasons, have been divesting, some of the brothers have been selling off their portions of the team, their ownership portions of the team. That's pretty much gone out the window. Now you're kind of on your own. If you want to get tickets or field passes or anything like that, you almost have to go through the regular procedures that anybody else would that would want to get those things. So one of the unfortunate things with the way estates work now is that because we've had to eliminate a lot of our interest in the team, at least my family and four of the other five families, you don't have those perks like you used to. But there's still a slight bit of prestige that you get from being one of the oldest, but not as much as like it used to be.
It is ironic. A lot of the audience will be Patriot-related audience, and the Crafts have insinuated in a positive way themselves into New England sports lore because of what they've done and how they've done it. You know, looking back as a member of one of the older patriarchal families of the NFL, what do you think of the job that the Crafts have done in resurrecting the Patriots?
No, I mean, it's just been unbelievable. I mean, that team, if you remember, I'm sure, Rick, going back years when it was the Sullivans and then Victor Keim, I think, took it over after them. They were just a team, that was, they'd have some decent years every once in a while, but then there'd be periods of just mediocrity, if not outright bad play and bad personnel decisions and things like that. And when Mr. Kraft came in and took over the ownership of that team, he brought a different philosophy. And I remember one of the stories being that, he used to go down, sort of like into the end zone area and greet the fans before games. And I remember a clip, I think it was on NFL Films, of a guy just basically mm-hmm. telling him, a fan, that, the intercom system was terrible and they couldn't really hear the announcements or the players' names or whatever. And I remember Kraft, actually listening to that guy, and then the next shot was them doing something with the public announcing system there to fix that. And you need that kind of a hands-on type of guy for a franchise like that, that was just kind of, again, muddled in mediocrity for a long time. And to have that mindset, I think, especially over the years, just shows, that the dedication that Mr. Kraft had to that team, but to the fans, to the organization as a whole, and that's how you start a championship type team, is from the ground up with everybody, grounds crew, people selling the popcorn, parking vendors, everything goes into it. And I think that's what Mr. Kraft has been able to do with such success there. Is build that from the ground up, and now you've had a run of almost 16, 17 years, which is unprecedented in the NFL, of success, and that really started with him and how he decided from day one that things were going to be run there, and it's just been reflective over these last 17 years of success.
Well, Pat Rooney, it sounds pretty similar to what your family's mantra has been with the Steelers ever since Patriarch Art bought the team in 1933, and then Dan. It's fans first, it's fans last, and fans in the middle. And the Steelers have done an incredible job of building that brand in Western Pennsylvania and also around the world. They're one of the top teams in Mexico, one of the top teams around the world, not only the terrible towels, but the history and legacy of the 70s and beyond. What's the one thing you can point to that got that done?
You know, I think it was, starting with my grandfather, I think it was just a personal touch, the ability for him to connect with what everybody, calls the quote unquote common man, which I think my grandfather wouldn't know what you were talking about because he viewed himself as a common man. You know, when he started his real job, which initially was working in a steel mill, and he made it half of a day and was sweating and dirty and filthy and just said to himself, even though his father and his grandfather before him, that's what they were doing, he just made it a point for himself that that was not the life he was going to lead. And he got involved in different interests, including boxing, promoting, and things like that. But sports was ultimately what he was most interested in. He was a amateur football player, baseball player, boxer. He made the Olympic team in 1920. He didn't ultimately go. But he was a man, a real Renaissance type person. He had a lot of interest, but he knew what he didn't want to do, and that was work in a steel mill. So he always had that ability. He did not come from a silver spoon background or anything like that, and he had the ability to relate to people and sort of understand what they were going through, understood what hard times were, and just was able throughout his life. To be able to connect to not just presidents and princes and people of high stature in society, but was much more able to relate to the common person. I can't tell you, Rick, how many times I'd be over at his house on a summer break or maybe around the holidays or something, and it almost happened without fail. Somebody would come to his door because he didn't live in a highfalutin neighborhood in Pittsburgh. People would come to his door and not necessarily to ask for money, although they did, but ask for, can he get them a job somewhere? Can he find something for them to do? And my grandfather, every time would either find something, he'd say, let me get back to you. And he'd write it down and make sure that he'd follow up on that. And that was just sort of, his core value system that, if he was put in a position to help people, he would do it, and that resonated throughout the blue collar town of Pittsburgh. They just viewed him as one of their own, and not somebody quote unquote special or anything like that. He was just a person who happened to be a hard worker in Pittsburgh, but that made it through a lot of those hard depression type times, and then was able to give back. And I think that's the one thing that. He was able to, however you do that, to bring that to the team where, again, the janitor or the custodian was on the same level as the president of the team in terms of a team moving towards a goal. And he viewed everybody with equal importance.
It would be great to get back to those days. So just hypothetically, you can't answer this question. That's the beauty of a hypothetical question. But it's been 85, 86 years since the Steelers came into being and Art Rooney originally. What do you think Art and maybe Dan now would think about the Patriots 17-year dynasty? Is it a, boy, they look like we used to look as far as off-field performing better than on the field that the Steelers did for 30, 40, 50 years, but that's a great opportunity, it's a great deal, or would there be a little bit of, hey, how about the old guys like the Bears or the Giants? We were real football, and these are kind of Johnny-come-latelys, or is a little bit in between?
I don't think so. I think I haven't really spoke to my Uncle Dan about, his thoughts on the Patriots per se, but I'm just knowing him, knowing the family the way we are, I think they're happy with what New England has been able to do. And we want to beat them and we wish we had some of the success that they've had because our team has been when decent these last, 15, 16 years as well, but we haven't been as good as they are. So there might be a little bit of that competitiveness, but that's my Uncle Dan took the same philosophy that my grandfather did. What he viewed everything as, is this good for the league? Is it good for the league as a whole that the Patriots are so good? And I think he, without question, would say yes. And for a couple of reasons, because there's a lot of people that like the Patriots. There's a lot of people from Boston, just like in Pittsburgh, that have left the New England area and they've moved to Arizona or they've moved to Florida. They moved somewhere else, but they've kept that allegiance to New England, and that sort of has spread to other parts of the country. And I think my uncle would say that's good for the league. But more importantly, almost, is there's a lot of people that hate New England. They're like Duke or the Yankees or, you know, teams that have been so good for so long, and you're getting sick of seeing Tom Brady on commercials and in movies and everywhere else and winning all the time. But that's
you forgot,
good, Rick. That's
you forgot Alabama. Yeah, we'll put Alabama in there in a minute. We'll get to that.
But that love-hate relationship with a team is actually, I think, a good thing for the league, because it polarizes people. And, you know, you get into arguments and stuff, but it's all good fun. But I think ultimately those types of dynasties are really good for the league, because people ultimately want to beat them or overcome them, and then, you know, then you go on to the next one. But I absolutely think my uncle couldn't be happier in one way that the Patriots are successful. Now, he wants to beat them, don't get me wrong. But at the same time, it's good for the league what the Patriots have been able to do.
You know, final question about the history of the NFL, but I think people all over the country ought to know this. Does your family look back, the Rooney family, at a sense of pride, as they should, along with the Halases and the Maras and Green Bay and the Fords, that you really made the league, that if there wasn't the fateful all for one and one for all in the late 50s and early 60s about sharing television money, there probably wouldn't be an NFL, certainly wouldn't be the Green Bay Packers, but it wouldn't be the NFL as strong as it is today, with franchises approaching $2 billion, and your family played a significant role in that. How does it make you feel?
Well, I think, you know, I have sort of talked to my uncle a little bit about this, and my dad, who, you know, was around during those times in the 40s and 50s, when my dad and my uncle were just young, you know, kids, teenagers. But in those days, Rick, the NFL wasn't even a second class league of something. In those days, boxing, horse racing, college football, and especially baseball were kind of the kings of sports, and pro football was really looked upon as I don't even think it was categorized as kind of a real sport type thing. It was, you know, guys trying to make money off of something that, you know, the pure college football arena, you know, it was a more pure arena. So in the 40s and then getting into the 50s, football was really a struggling entity. And there was really no guarantee that it was going to continue to be able to be something on an ongoing basis that was going to make money. And my grandfather always said, you know, his biggest thing was not winning on Sundays. It was making payroll on Mondays, because, you know, again, you just didn't know if you were going to get, you know, the people to come out and see the game. So when the game was starting to grow in the 50s, the teams like the Giants and the Redskins and you know, the sort of the, from the main television or the population markets, you know, when they go to Pittsburgh, you know, that's when we'd have our biggest crowds, because you get people that couldn't necessarily get tickets or whatever in New York. They'd come to Pittsburgh or Washington. They'd come to Pittsburgh to see the game. So that would help our gate. And really what happened was those teams started saying, hey, this is Washington and New York, they'd say, this is unfair. You guys are making all this money off of our fans that are coming to your games and spending money on parking and stuff like that. So really, it wasn't quite, I don't think, as altruistic as a lot of people thought it was going to be, but those teams sort of said, we want part of the gate. We want part of this because, you know, that's we're losing money because our fans are going to see in your venue. And so what I think happened when the TV started popping up in the late 50s, early 60s, is that revenue sharing mantra just took the next step with TV. And it ended up, obviously, like you're saying, you wouldn't have a team like Green Bay or some of these other real small market teams. They wouldn't be around today. But TV and that revenue sharing was able to keep a lot of those teams afloat through their bad years. And ultimately, when we got to the Super Bowl era and the sport exploded, the sport of pro football, it was like the rising tide, you know, lifted all the boats. So it was a weird thing in the early, you know, in the 40s and early 50s of the quote unquote revenue sharing concept, that it wasn't quite like the Giants were like, hey, we want everybody. The Giants just wanted their take of what they thought was, you know, belonged to them. But that ultimately, either, you know, through luck or however you want to categorize it, ended up being a great thing for the league as a whole.
Altruistic or not, it's certainly a great place in history, and the Rooneys deserve their highest place. Now, think carefully. This is the last question I'm going to ask you. If you had to make this choice, which one would it be? You've won in the Florida House for three elections, District 85, from 2010 to 2016. If you were granted a winning of an election for the rest of your life, A, B, your beloved Clemson winning another national championship, or C, the Steelers winning the Super Bowl, which is it?
Oh, boy, that is a tough one. I mean, you can throw the election one out. I got my fill of that for the 6 years. But the Clemson was really special only because I got there in 82, so I missed the championship year in 81 by a year, and then we went on probation probably because of what we did to get to the championship in 81. So for the 4 years I was there, we were basically on probation. We couldn't go to any bowl games or any of that kind of stuff. So this one, this last week, was really special because my kids are now getting a little bit older, and they know that, you know, I take pride in coming and going to Clemson and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, just strictly for, you know, the my family as a whole, Rick, I'd have to say if we could get in another Super Bowl, I you know, and I don't want to sound, as my dad would say, hoggy, because, you know, we're fortunate enough to have six already, but those are just such special times when you can go with your family to the game, and if they're lucky enough to win the game, there's such a sense of euphoria and happiness that really there's nothing else on earth that I've ever experienced in my life, with the exception of maybe my kids being born, that can match that feeling, even if it only lasts for a few days. But, boy, it's such a fun thing to be able to share with your family, especially, you know, my kids are still relatively young, and to see the looks on their faces when the confetti's coming down and everything, it's, you can't buy that.
Ladies and gentlemen, good friend Pat Rooney, he's no longer in politics, but that sounded like a classic political answer. Rick Haro, Beyond the Scoreboard, be back in a minute. Now it's time for the top issues of the week. If you want to see the full list of all 15, look at CSNNE.com. Budding high school football players have an alternative to attending college for 3 years before turning pro. It's called Pacific Pro Football. It is a brainchild of NFL agent Don Yee, the CEO of Pac Pro. By the way, he's also Tom Brady's agent, as you may know. It's intended to give young prospects a professional outlet to prepare for the NFL. And if the first season goes according to plan, the league hopes to expand into Northern California and the Midwest. It's an interesting concept, would be my take, that identifies an underutilized niche in the market. The league has been planning stages for this for a while, but yet, after the WFL, USFL, and World League of American Football, the sporting public may be looking forward to another fresh alternative. It's certainly been a long time since the last one, by the way. At the same time, MLB pushes to create more African-American pitcher and catcher prospects. It may pay off. High school pitcher Hunter Green projected to be the first player chosen in the MLB draft. African-American population in the MLB is hovering around 8%. And the guy who directs MLB's Urban Youth Academy, David Miller, says talking about it is one thing, but seeing guys come through the academies, it's another. And my take is this: the success of diversity programs has to be evaluated with patience, deliberation, and long-term vision. This is one of those cases, by the way, and look for increased and consistent talent payoff in the times ahead. And then, how about this in San Jose? The Sharks have a new ticket pricing guide, which is sales history. The SAP Center leads the way toward developing these assets, and the 16 different available ticket prices at the SAP Center jumps to 32 next season. The glass seats, the behind the glass, $137 to $222, will go for $300 to $400 based on sales history. And there are a whole bunch of technical issues here. Sales history is one example, and then variable pricing introduced in Toronto and other places this year is another, where tickets to rivals will cost more than tickets to non-rivals. And as usual, here's the take. SAP's center leads the way in technological and market innovation. Using the parent company SAP's vision and business acumen, the building now has added ammunition with which to appeal to customers and maneuver in a highly competitive market. By the way, excuse the horns and the cacophony behind me. We're at the inauguration week, and this is Washington. What more do I need to say, by the way? Also, how about this? The Niners suing Santa Clara after the city claimed that the team violated its contract. The Niners have invited auditors to Levi's Stadium, and the team wants to settle the score before requiring the city to sign documents verifying no breaches occurred. The lawsuit says the stadium authority has embarked on a scheme to concoct and fabricate false accusations of breach or non-performance to create a pretext for terminating the stadium management agreement. And the stadium just opened. And my take is it continues to bring in significant international events such as the Super Bowl and major soccer festivals. The parties continue to litigate over emotional performance issues. Hopefully they can be resolved quickly in order to focus on the bigger picture. The bigger picture is getting the Niners competitive again for the entire industry. How about this story, which should impact people in Boston? The economic study commissioned by LA 2024 said that hosting the Summer Olympics in LA could generate as much as $11 billion in economic output for the city, about 80,000 jobs, about $160 million in tax revenues, and 3.3 million visitors attending. And my take is this. Civic studies arguing about this are sometimes self-serving, but for the most part, this one reflects the tremendous economic potential the Games will have for the region. Most studies also ignore the business benefits, the branding, the public relations, and the international awareness benefits that come to a region after hosting a two-week mega event. And by the way, Mayor Marty Walsh had his reasons, and the Boston bid has been now in the rearview mirror. See if L.A. picks up the slack. 2017 selection between L.A., Budapest, and Paris. I'm putting my money on L.A. In a unanimous decision, FIFA voted to expand the World Cup field from 32 to 48 in 2026. The new format features 16 groups of three teams. The top two qualify for a knockout round of 32. It represents the top two teams from all eight groups advancing to the round of 16. The current format, this is a tinkering. The good thing is the World Cup in 2026 may be likely to be hosted in North America, U.S., Canada, and Mexico, preparing to submit a joint bid. The plans will see the total number of games increase from 64 to 80 and $1 billion extra for the governing body. A lot of people say this is an effort to line the pockets of FIFA, but here's my take. Any tinkering has critics, and kudos to Gianni Infantino, the new FIFA guy, for attempting to shake up the World Cup format, and also to increase global participation on an unprecedented scale. Now let's go down under. The pro tennis circuit is at the Australian Open, and American tennis fans might be able to sock it to me. How's that? It's cute, but the young Nebraskan, Jack Sock, he's 24, he won his second career title in New Zealand, one of the run-up tournaments to the Australian Open beginning on Monday. He amassed $4.8 million in prize money, ranked number 20. He only needs three wins in Melbourne to supplant number 19 John Isner as the highest-ranking American on the ATP Tour. And on the women's side, all eyes still on Serena. The tennis calendar's first major has raised its total prize money to about $36 million in terms of the tournament's stunning growth. And the equal prize money, $2.7 million for each men's and women's singles champ, increased by more than $200,000 this last year. And my take is this. Kudos to that tournament for confirming and validating equal prize money, and more good news for American tennis. According to the Physical Activity Council, U.S. tennis participation increased to 17 million players, up 1% from 2013, meaning a slightly bigger pool from which to farm much-needed future American stars. Now we go to San Diego, or maybe we go to L.A. Southern California city that had no NFL teams last year will boast two. Dean Spanos made the official announcement that his team would be moving to L.A. beginning with the 2017 season. They'll play in StubHub Center, which is only 30,000 spectators, a massive downgrade from Qualcomm, but yet, in 2 years, they go into their $2.6 billion stadium in L.A. to share with the Rams. The logo features the letters L and A, arranged similarly to the Dodgers logo. It'll have a lightning bolt, but some people say L.A. and add M.E. to it with Lame. Those are people in San Diego. And in terms of what happens in San Diego, everybody knows the team leaves. But what people may not know is that the Chargers contributed about $13 million to local charities, 1.3 million meals to the San Diego Food Bank, 200,000 lives saved through blood drives, and the intangible benefits of a team really important. But here's my take. A franchise musical chairs, it's almost over, at least for now. The Chargers' economics dictate that a share of the larger pot of revenue in L.A. better than more time and effort chasing stadium projects by themselves. Now it's the Raiders' turn to take center stage. Finally, you can't ignore it. President-elect Donald Trump's sports industry involvement has been well chronicled, especially his golf holdings. And the bottom line is, you like it, you don't, you voted for him, you didn't, you go to a movie, you go to the inauguration. Whatever your issue is, it's time for healing. And so one thing is very clear. To an international audience, the new presidency will confirm a period of uncertainty, more politically charged decisions, but also a different business perspective brought to the Oval Office. Good, bad, indifferent, that is in fact the case. He's got 17 golf holdings, number 22 Turnberry, number 54 on the Golf 100 Digest list at the new Trump facility in Scotland. Obviously, a successful business golf venture, whether the courses are making money or not. And time will tell, my take, on whether the new president's tough talk on trade will pan out and what will happen as far as sports business down the road. But again, the one thing is certain, there is more healing involved in the peaceful transition of power than anybody knew. Regardless of the marches that would follow, the American democratic system certainly is great, not only from a sports perspective, but every other. And those are the big issues for the week. Again, you want the full list? Look at CSNNE.com. And now, my final take. More than 200,000 lives saved, $13 million donated, and unquantifiable exposure for local charities. Over 56 years, the San Diego Chargers have done much more for America's finest city than play games on a football field. As the dust settles on the San Diego Chargers' announcement they're moving to Los Angeles, attention now focuses on the market they're leaving behind. What will the day-to-day impact be on a Chargerless city? While the game day economic impact will be mostly felt by stadium-adjacent small businesses like bars and restaurants, parking facilities, and Uber drivers, the biggest hits will likely affect the region's nonprofits and tourism sales. The Chargers' relocation is only the most recent announcement of how a team's city hopping can cause a disruption in the ecosystem created by the NFL. Certainly, in 30 years in the business, I understand what it means for stadium development as it relates to the justification of the move to Los Angeles. There is no argument here for that. But the relocation in this context of this means the NFL tries to be a good corporate citizen. The NFL Foundation hands out millions of dollars each year through its Play 60 Challenge, a Crucial Catch American Cancer Society partnership, and individual player foundation grants. In San Diego, the Chargers contributed or facilitated about $13 million to local charities, including providing 1.6 million meals to the San Diego Food Bank and helping the San Diego Blood Bank save 200,000 lives through blood drives. As for tourism, quote, "I can't pay for that kind of exposure," Tourism Authority CEO Joe Terzi told the Union Tribune, referring to the beauty shots of sparkling beaches and sunny skies during televised Chargers games. "The Chargers food drive gives us an opportunity to create an awareness for hunger and visibility for the San Diego Food Bank," CEO James Flores told a television station. "So we kind of put together all the financial contributions and all the food that's been donated through our efforts with the Chargers. It comes out to about 1.6 million meals. One pint of blood saves three lives," added San Diego Blood Bank CEO David Wellis. "The partnership between the Blood Bank and the San Diego Chargers saved over 200,000 lives. Quote, "There's no organization that's done more for San Diego County children than the San Diego Chargers," chimes in James Esterbrooks of the Chargers Champions. "We're talking about hundreds of thousands of children. As someone who's been involved in community programs, we've seen what's been happening, and this is obviously a big deal." The bottom line, the intangible benefits of having an NFL team in your city, especially to the business and nonprofit sectors,
and to community identity and pride matter much more than season ticket sales and naming rights deals. As President Obama mused on Monday when he welcomed the world champion Chicago Cubs to the White House during his last official event as first fan, quote, "It's worth remembering because sometimes people wonder, why do you spend time on sports? Sports has changed attitudes and cultures in ways that seem subtle, but that ultimately make us think differently about ourselves and who we are. Sports has a way of sometimes changing hearts in a way that politics or business doesn't, and sometimes it's just a matter of us being able to escape and relax from the difficulties of our days. Sometimes it also speaks to something better in us. To President Obama, amen, clearly the case. To the NFL, obviously understand the decision to go to L.A. To San Diego, certainly you'll miss the Chargers. That's my final take."
That's our show for the week, chronicling an incredibly busy week. We'd like to thank Pat Rooney for lending his expertise, and you probably would like to thank him too, even though he is a Steeler. Good luck to everybody else this weekend, an incredible NFC and AFC championship weekend as well. Again, if you want, look for us on Stitcher, Google Play, Audio Boom, and subscribe to our iTunes feed as well. And look for our 15 to watch list on CSNNE.com. Sports Professor Rick Haro, another big week next week. Please join us when we go Beyond the Scoreboard.